That Pretty Girl in the Army by Henry Lawson. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Dramatis Personae.
Sister Hannah, read by Devorah Allen.
Jack Moonlight, Bushman and Shearer's Rep, read by Thomas Peter.
Billy Woods, read by Jim Locke.
Jake Borum, read by Larry Wilson.
Reformed Drunkard, read by Wayne Cook.
Bob Brothers, read by Algie Pug.
Mitchell, read by Alan Mapstone.
Donald MacDonald, read by Michelle Eaton.
One-Eyed Bogan, read by Lorda.
Female Testifier, read by Lauren Emma.
Plunderer, read by Therese Lindholm.
The Black Testifier, read by Wayne Cook.
Heckler, read by Todd.
Narrator, read by Kristen Hand. Now I often sit at Waddy's when the night is very near, with a head that's full of jingles and the fumes of bottled beer. For I always have a fancy, if I am over there, when the army prays for Waddy, I'm included in the prayer. It would take a lot of praying, lots of thumping on the drum, to prepare our sinful, straying, erring souls for kingdom come. But I love my fellow sinners, and I hope, upon the whole, that the army gets a hearing when it prays for Waddy's soul. When the World Was Wide. The Salvation Army does good business in some of the outback towns of the great pastoral wastes of Australia. There's the thoughtless, careless generosity of the bushman, whose pockets don't go far enough down his trousers. That's what's the matter with him. And who contributes to anything that comes along without troubling to ask questions. Like Long Bob Brothers of Burke, who, chancing to be a Protestant by rights, unwittingly subscribed towards the erection of a new Catholic church, and being chaffed for his mistake, said,
"Ah, well, I don't suppose it'll matter a hang in the end, any way it goes. I ain't got nothing against Roman Catholics."
There's the shearer, fresh with his check from a cutout shed, gloriously drunk and happy, in love with all the world, and ready to subscribe towards any creed and shout for all hands, including old Nick if he happened to come along. There's the shearer, half-drunk and inclined to be nasty, who's got the wrong end of all things with a tight grip, and who flings a shilling in the face of outback conventionality, as he thinks, by chucking a bob into the Salvation Army ring. Then he glares round to see if he can catch anybody winking behind his back. There's the cynical joker, a queer mixture who contributes generously and tempts the reformed boozer afterwards. There's the severe-faced old station hand, in clean shirt and neckerchief and white moleskins, in for his annual or semi-annual spree, who contributes on principle and then drinks religiously until his check is gone and the horrors are come. There's the shearer, feeling mighty bad after a spree and in danger of seeing things when he tries to go to sleep. He has dropped 10 or 20 pounds over bar counters and at cards, and now he chucks a repentant shilling into the ring, with a very private and rather vague sort of feeling that something might come of it. There's the stout, contented, good-natured publican who tips the army as if it were a barrel organ. And there are others and other reasons, black sheep and ne'er-do-wells, and faint echoes of other times in Salvation Army tunes. Burke, the metropolis of the Great Scrubs, on the banks of the Darling River, about 500 miles from Sydney, was suffering from a long drought when I was there in 92, and the heat may or may not have been another cause contributing to the success, from a business point of view, of the Burke garrison. There was much beer boozing, and besides, it was vaguely understood, as most things are vaguely understood out there in the drought haze, that the place the army came to save us from was hotter than Burke. We didn't hanker to go to a hotter place than Burke. But that year there was an extraordinary reason for the Army's great financial success there. She was a little girl, 19 or 20, I should judge, the prettiest girl I ever saw in the Army, and one of the prettiest I've ever seen out of it. She had the features of an angel, but her expression was wonderfully human, sweet and sympathetic. Her big gray eyes were sad with sympathy, for sufferers and sinners, and her poke bonnet was full of bunchy red gold hair. Her first appearance was somewhat dramatic. Perhaps the army arranged it so. The army used to pray and thump the drum and sing and take up collections every evening outside Wadi Bothway's hotel, the Carrier's Arms. They performed longer and more often outside Wadi's than any other pub in town. Perhaps because Wadi was considered the most hopeless publican and his customers the hardest crowd of boozers in Burke. The band generally began to play about dusk. Wadi would lean back comfortably in a basket easy chair on his wide veranda and clasp his hands in a calm, contented way while the army banged the drum and got steam up, and whilst perhaps there was a barney going on in the bar or a bloodthirsty fight in the backyard. On such occasions, there was something like an indulgent or fatherly expression on his fat and usually emotionless face. And by, he'd move his head gently and doze. The banging and the singing seemed to soothe him, and the praying, which was often very personal, never seemed to disturb him in the least. Well, it was about dusk one day. It had been a terrible day, 100-something startling in the shade, but there came a breeze after sunset. There had been several dozen of buckets of water thrown on the veranda floor and the ground outside. Wadi was seated in his accustomed place when the army arrived. There was no Barney in the bar because there was a fight in the backyard, and that claimed the attention of all the customers. The army prayed for Wadi and his clients. Then a reformed drunkard started to testify against publicans and all their works. Wadi settled himself comfortably, folded his hands, and leaned back and dozed. The fight was over, and the chaps began to drop round to the bar. The man who was saved waved his arms and danced around and howled.
"Yes!"
he shouted hoarsely.
"The publicans and the boozers and the gamblers and sinners might think that Burke is hot, but hell is 1,000 times hotter, I tell you."
"Oh, Lord!"
said Mitchell, the shearer, and he threw a penny into the ring.
"Yes, I tell you that hell is 1,000,000 times hotter than Burke, I tell you."
"Hi, look here,"
said a voice from the background.
"That won't wash. Why, don't you know that when the Burke people die, they send back for their blankets?"
The saved brother glared round.
"Oh, you're a free thinker speaking, my friends,"
he said. Then, with sudden inspiration and renewed energy,
"I hear the voice of a free thinker. Show me the face of a free thinker,"
he yelled, glaring round like a hunted, hungry man.
"Show me the face of a free thinker, and I'll tell you what he is."
Wadi hitched himself into a more comfortable position and clasped his hands on his knee and closed his eyes again.
"Yes,"
shrieked the brand.
"I'll tell you, my friends, I can tell a free thinker by his face. Show me the face of a..."
At this point, there was an interruption. One-eyed or wall-eyed Bogan, who had a broken nose and the best side of whose face was reckoned the ugliest and most sinister, One-eyed Bogan thrust his face forward from the ring of darkness into the torchlight of salvation. He had got the worst of a drawn battle. His nose and mouth were bleeding, and his good eye was damaged.
"Look at my face,"
he snarled with dangerous earnestness.
"Look at my face. That's the face of a three-thinker, and I don't care who knows it. Now, what have you go to say against my face? Man without a shirt?"
The brother drew back. He had been known in the Northwest in his sinful days as Man Without a Shirt, alias Shirty, or the Dirty Man, and was flabbergasted at being recognized in speech. Also, he had been in a shearing shed and in a shanty orgy with One-Eyed Bogan and knew the man. Now, most of the chaps respected the army, and indeed anything that looked like religion, but the Bogan's face, as representing free thought, was a bit too sudden for them. There were sounds on the opposite side of the ring as from men being smitten repeatedly and rapidly below the belt, and Long Tom Hall and one or two others got away into the darkness in the background, where Tom rolled helplessly on the grass and sobbed. It struck me that Bogan's face was more the result of free speech than anything else. The army was about to pray when the pretty girl stepped forward, her eyes shining with indignation and enthusiasm. She had arrived by the evening train and had been standing shrinkingly behind an army lass of 50 Australian summers, who was about 6 feet high, flat and broad, and had a square face and a mouth like a joint in boilerplates. The pretty girl stamped her pretty foot on the gravel, and her eyes flashed in the torchlight.
"You ought to be ashamed of yourselves,"
she said.
"Great big men like you to be going on the way you are. If you were ignorant or poor, as I've seen people, there might be some excuse for you. Haven't you got any mothers or sisters or wives to think of? What sort of a life is this you lead? Drinking and gambling and fighting and swearing your lives away. Do you ever think of God and the time when you were children? Why don't you make homes? Look at that man's face."
She pointed suddenly at Bogan, who collapsed and sidled behind his mates out of the light.
"Look at that man's face. Is it a face for a Christian? And you help and encourage him to fight? You're worse than he is. Oh, it's brutal. It's wicked. Great big men like you, you ought to be ashamed of yourselves."
Long Bob Brothers, about 6'4", the longest and most innocent there, shrunk down by the wall and got his inquiring face out of the light. The pretty girl fluttered on for a few moments longer, greatly excited, and then stepped back, seemingly much upset, and was taken under the wing of the woman with the boilerplate mouth. It was a surprise and very sudden. Bogan slipped round to the backyard and was seen bathing his battered features at the pump. The rest wore the expression of men who knew that something unusual has happened, but don't know what, and are waiting vacantly for developments. Except Tom Hall, who had recovered and returned. He stood looking over the head of the ring of bushmen, and apparently taking the same critical interest in the girl as he would in a fight. His expression was such as a journalist might wear who is getting exciting copy. The army had it all their own way for the rest of the evening and made a good collection. The pretty girl stood smiling round with shining eyes as the Bobs and Tanners dropped in, and then, being shoved forward by the flat woman, she thanked us sweetly and said we were good fellows and that she was sorry for some things she said to us. Then she retired, fluttering and very much flushed, and hid herself behind the hard woman, who, by the way, had an excrescence on her upper lip which might have stood for a rivet. Presently, the pretty girl came from behind the big woman and stood watching things with glistening eyes. Some of the chaps on the opposite side of the ring moved a little to one side, and all were careful not to meet her eye, not to be caught looking at her, lest she should be embarrassed. Waddy had roused himself a little at the sound of a strange voice in the army, and such a clear, sweet voice, too, and had a look. Then he settled back peacefully again, but it was noticed that he didn't snore that evening. And when the army prayed, the pretty girl knelt down with the rest on the gravel. One or two tall bushmen bowed their heads as if they had to, and One-Eyed Bogan, with the blood washed from his face, stood with his hat off, glaring round to see if he could catch anyone sniggering. Mitchell, the shearer, said afterwards that the whole business made him feel, for the moment, like he felt sometimes in the days when he used to feel things. The town discussed the pretty girl in the army that night and for many days thereafter, but no one could find out who she was or where she belonged to, except that she came from Sydney last. She kept her secret, if she had one, very close, or else the other S.A. women were not to be pumped. She lived in skillion rooms at the back of the big weatherboard Salvation Army barracks with two other lassies, who did washing and sewing and nursing, and went shabby and half-starved themselves and were baked in the heat, like scores of women in the bush, and even as hundreds of women suffering from religious mania slave and stint in city slums and neglect their homes, husbands, and children, for the glory of Booth. The pretty girl was referred to as Sister Hannah by the army people and came somehow to be known by sinners as Miss Captain. I don't know whether that was her real name or what rank she held in the army, if indeed she held any. She sold war cries, and the circulation doubled in a day. One-Eyed Bogan, being bailed up unexpectedly, gave her half a caser for a cry and ran away without the paper or the change. Jack Mitchell bought a cry for the first time in his life and read it. He said he found some of the articles intensely realistic, and many of the statements were very interesting. He said he read one or two things in the cry that he didn't know before. Tom Hall, taken unawares, bought three cries from the pretty girl and blushed to find it fame. Little Billy Woods, the Laborers Union secretary, who had a poetic temperament and more than the average bushman's reverence for higher things, Little Billy Woods told me in a burst of confidence that he generally had two feelings, one after the other, after encountering that girl. One was that unfathomable, faraway feeling of loneliness and longing that comes at odd times to the best of married men, with the best of wives and children, as Billy had. The other feeling, which came later on, and was a reaction, in fact, was the feeling of a man who thinks he's been twisted round a woman's little finger for the benefit of somebody else. Billy said that he couldn't help being reminded by the shy, sweet smile and the shy, sweet thank you of the pretty girl in the army, of the shy, sweet smile and the shy, sweet gratitude of a Sydney private barmaid who had once roped him in the days before he was married. Then he'd reckoned that the army lassie had been sent out back to Burke as a business speculation. Tom Hall was inclined to reckon so too, but that was after he'd been chaffed for a month about three war cries. The pretty girl was discussed from psychological points of view, not forgetting the sex problem. Donald MacDonald, shearer, union leader, and labor delegate to other colonies on occasion, Donald MacDonald said that whenever he saw a circle of plain or ugly dried-up women or girls round a shepherd, evangelist, or a Salvation Army drum, he'd say,
"Sexually starved."
They were hungry for love. Religious mania was sexual passion damned out of its course. Therefore, he held that morbidly religious girls were the most easily seduced. But this couldn't apply to pretty girl in the army. Mitchell reckoned that she'd either had a great sorrow, a lot of trouble, or a disappointment in love. The "or" is Mitchell's. But they couldn't see how a girl like her could possibly be disappointed in love, unless the chap died or got into jail for life. Donald decided that her soul had been starved somehow. Mitchell suggested that it might be only a craving for notoriety, the same thing that makes women and girls go amongst lepers and out to the battlefield and nurse ugly pieces of men back to life again, the same thing that makes some women and girls swear ropes round men's necks. The pretty girl might be the daughter of well-to-do people, even aristocrats, said Mitchell. She was pretty enough and spoke well enough.
"Every woman's a barmaid at heart,
as the bulletin puts it," said Mitchell. But not even one of the haggard women of Burke ever breathed a suspicion of scandal against her. They said she was too good and too pretty to be where she was. You see, it was not as in an old settled town where hags blackened God's word with their tongues. Burke was just a little camping town in a big land where free, good-hearted, democratic Australians and the best of black sheep from the old world were constantly passing through, where husbands were often obliged to be away from home for 12 months, and the storekeepers had to trust the people, and mates trusted each other, and the folks were broad-minded. The mind's eye had a wide range. After her maiden speech, the pretty girl seldom spoke, except to return thanks for collections. And she never testified. She had a sweet voice and used to sing. Now, if I were writing pure fiction and were not cursed with an obstinate inclination to write the truth, I might say that after the advent of the pretty girl, the morals of Burke improved suddenly and wonderfully. That one-eyed Bogan left off gambling and drinking and fighting and swearing and put on a red coat and testified and fought the devil only. That Mitchell dropped his mask of cynicism. That Donald MacDonald ate no longer of the tree of knowledge and ceased to worry himself with psychological problems and was happy. And that Tom Hall was no longer a scoffer. That no one sneaked round through the scrub after dusk to certain necessary establishments in weather-board cottages on the outskirts of the town, and that the broad-minded and obliging ladies thereof became Salvation Army lassies. But none of these things happened. Drunks quieted down or got out of the way, if they could, when the pretty girl appeared on the scene. Fights and games of Hednum were adjourned, and weak ordinary language was used for the time being, and that was about all. Nevertheless, most of the chaps were in love with that pretty girl in the army, all those who didn't worship her privately. Long Bob Brothers hovered round in hopes, they said, that she'd meet with an accident, get run over by a horse or something, and he'd have to carry her in. He scared the women at the barracks by dropping firewood over the fence after dark. Barku Rat, the meanest man in the back country, was seen to drop a 3-penny bit into the ring, and a rumor was industriously circulated by Tom Hall, to the effect that One-Eyed Bogan intended to shave and join the army disguised as a lassie. Handsome Jake Borham, alias Borum, a sentimental shearer from New Zealand who had read Bret Hart, made an elaborate attempt for the pretty girl by pretending to be going to the dogs headlong, with an idea of first winning her sorrowful interest and sympathy, and then making an apparently hard struggle to straighten up for her sake. He related his experience with a cheerful and refreshing absence of reserve which was characteristic of him, and is of most bushmen.
"I'd had a few drinks,"
he said,
"and was having a spell under a gum by the river, when I saw the pretty girl and another army woman coming down along the bank. It was a blazing hot day. I thought of Sandy and the schoolmistress in Bret Harte, and I thought it would be a good idea to stretch out in the sun and pretend to be helpless. So I threw my hat on the ground and lay down, with my head in the blazing heat, in the most graceful position I could get at, and tried to put a look of pained regret on my face, as if I was dreaming of my lost boyhood and me mother. I thought perhaps the girl would pity me, and I felt sure she'd stoop and pick up my hat and put it gently over my poor troubled head. Then I was going to become conscious for a moment, and look hopelessly round and into her eyes, and then start to look sorrowful and ashamed, and stagger to my feet, taking off my hat like the Silver King does to the audience when he makes his first appearance drunk on the stage. And then I was going to reel off, trying to walk as straight as I could. And next day I was going to clean up my teeth and nails and put on a white shirt and start to be a new man henceforth. Well, as I lay there with my eyes shut, I heard the footsteps come up and stop, and heard him whisper, and I thought I heard the pretty girl say, 'Poor fellow,' or something that sounded like that, and just then I got a God-almighty poke in the ribs with an umbrella. At least I suppose it was aimed for my ribs, but women are bad shots, and the point of the umbrella caught me in the side, just between the bottom rib and the hip bone, and I sat up with a click like the blade of a pocket-knife. The other lassie was the big square-faced woman. The pretty girl looked rather more frightened and disgusted than sentimental, but she had plenty of pluck and soon pulled herself together. She said I ought to be ashamed of myself, a great big man like me lying here in the dust like a drunken tramp, an eyesore and a disgrace to all the world. She told me to go to my camp, wherever that was, and sleep myself sober. The square-jawed woman said I looked like a fool sitting there. I did feel ashamed, and I reckon I did look like a fool. A man generally does in a fix like that. I felt like one, anyway. I got up and walked away, and it hurt me so much that I went over to Westbrook and went to the dogs properly for a fortnight, and lost 20 quid on a game of draughts against a blindfold player. Now, both those women had umbrellas, but I'm not sure to this day which of them was that gave me the poke. It wouldn't have mattered much anyway. I haven't borrowed one of Bret Harte's books since."
Jake reflected a while.
"The worst of it was,"
he said ruefully,
"that I wasn't sure that the girl or the woman didn't see through me, and that worried me a bit. You never can tell how much a woman suspects, and that's the worst of 'em. I found that out after I got married."
The pretty girl in the army grew pale and thin and bigger-eyed. The women said it was a shame and that she ought to be sent home to her friends, wherever they were. She was laid up for 2 or 3 days, and some of the women cooked delicacies and handed 'em over the barracks fence and offered to come in and nurse her, but the square woman took washing home and nursed the girl herself. The pretty girl still sold war cries and took up collections, but in a tired, listless, half-shamefaced way. It was plain that she was tired of the army and growing ashamed of the Salvationists. Perhaps she had come to see things too plainly. You see, the army does no good out back in Australia, except from a business point of view. It is simply there to collect funds for hungry headquarters. The bushmen are much too intelligent for the army. There was no poverty in Bourke, as it is understood in the city. There was plenty of food, and camping out and roughing it come natural to the bushmen. In cases of sickness, accidents, widows or orphans, the chaps send round the hat, without banging a drum or testifying, and that was all right. If a chap was hard up, he borrowed a couple quid from his mate. If a strange family arrived without a penny, someone had to fix him up, and the storekeepers helped him till the man got work. For the rest, we work out our own salvation, or damnation, as the case is, in the bush, with no one to help us, except a mate, perhaps. The army can't help us, but a fellow sinner can, sometimes, who's been through it all himself. The army is only a drag on the progress of democracy, because it attracts many who would otherwise be aggressive Democrats, and for other reasons. Besides, if we all reformed, the army would get deuced little from us for its city mission. The pretty girl went to service for a while with the stock inspector's wife, who could get nothing out of her concerning herself or her friends. She still slept at the barracks, stuck to the army, and attended its meetings. It was Christmas morning, and there was peace in Burke and goodwill towards all men. There hadn't been a fight since yesterday evening, and that had only been a friendly one, to settle an argument concerning the past ownership, and at the same time to decide as to the future possession of a dog. It had been a hot, close night, and it ended in a suffocating sunrise. The free portion of the male population were in the habit of taking their blankets and sleeping out in the park, or town square, in hot weather. The wives and daughters of the town slept, or tried to sleep, with bedroom windows and doors open, while husbands lay outside on the verandas. I camped in a corner of the park that night, and the sun woke me. As I sat up, I caught sight of a swagman coming along the white, dusty road from the direction of the bridge, where the cleared road ran across west and on, 130 miles, through the barren, broiling Mulga scrubs, to Hungerford, on the border of Shoal. I knew that swagman's walk. It was John Merrick, Jack Moonlight, one-time Shearers Union secretary at Coonamble, and generally rep, Shearers representative, in any shed where he sheared. He was a better-class shearer, one of those quiet, thoughtful men of whom there are generally two or three in the roughest of rough sheds, who have great influence and give the shed a good name from a union point of view. Not quiet with the resentful or snobbish reserve of the educated Englishman, but with a sad or subdued sort of quietness that has force in it, as if they fully realized that their intelligence is much higher than the average, that they have suffered more real trouble and heartbreak than the majority of their mates, and that their mates couldn't possibly understand them if they spoke as they felt and couldn't see things as they do. Yet men who understand and are intensely sympathetic in their loneliness and sensitive reserve. I had worked in a shed with Jack Moonlight and had met him in Sydney, and to be mates with a bushman for a few weeks is to know him well. Anyway, I found it so. He had taken a trip to Sydney the Christmas before last, and when he came back there was something wanting. He became more silent, he drank more, and sometimes alone, and took to smoking heavily. He dropped his mates, took little or no interest in union matters, and traveled alone and at night. The Australian bushman is born with a mate who sticks to him through life, like a mole. They may be hundreds of miles apart sometimes and separated for years, yet they are mates for life. A bushman may have many mates in his roving, but there is always one, his mate, my mate, and it is common to hear a bushman who is in every way a true mate to the man he happens to be traveling with speak of his mate's mate, Jack's mate, who might be in Klondike or South Africa. A bushman has always a mate to comfort him and argue with him and work and tramp and drink with him, and to lend him quids when he's hard up, and call him a bee fool, and fight him sometimes, to abuse him to his face, and defend his name behind his back, to bear false witness and perjure his soul for his sake, to lie to the girl for him if he's single, and to his wife if he's married, to secure a pen for him at a shed where he isn't on the spot, or, if the mate is away in New Zealand or South Africa, to write and tell him if it's any good coming over this way. And each would take the word of the other against all the world, and each believes that the other is the straightest chap that ever lived, a white man. And next best to your old mate is the man you're tramping, riding, working, or drinking with. About the first thing the cook asks you when you come along to a shearer's hut is, where's your mate? I traveled alone for a while one time, and it seemed to me sometimes, by the tone of the inquiry concerning the whereabouts of my mate, that the bush had an idea I might have done away with him, and that the thing ought to be looked into. When a man drops mateship altogether and takes to hatting in the bush, it is a step toward a convenient tree and a couple saddle straps buckled together. I had an idea that I, in a measure, took the place of Jack Moonlight's mate about this time. "Hello, Jack," I hailed as he reached the corner of the park.
"Good morning, Harry,"
said Jack, as if he'd seen me last yesterday evening instead of 3 months ago.
"How are you getting on?"
We walked together towards the union office, where I had a camp in the skillion room at the back. Jack was silent. But there's no place in the world where a man's silence is respected so much, within reasonable bounds, as in the Australian bush, where every man has a past more or less sad, and every man a ghost, perhaps from other lands that we know nothing of, and speaking in a foreign tongue. They say in the bush, oh, Jack's only thinking, and they let him think. Generally, you want to think as much as your mate, and when you've been together some time, it's quite natural to travel all day without exchanging a word. In the morning, Jim says, well, I think I made a bargain with that horse, Bill, and sometime late in the afternoon, say 20 miles farther on, it occurs to Bill to rejoin, well, I reckon the blank as sold it to you had your proper. I like a good thinking mate, and I believe that thinking in company is a lot more healthy and more comfortable, as well as less risky than thinking alone. On the way to the Union office, Jack and I passed the Royal Hotel and caught a glimpse through the open door of a bedroom off the veranda of the landlord's fresh, fair, young Sydney girl wife, sleeping prettily behind the mosquito net, like a sleeping beauty, while the boss lay on a mattress outside on the veranda across the open door. He wasn't necessary for publication, but an evidence of good faith. I glanced at Jack for a grin, but I didn't get one. He wore the pained expression of a man who is suddenly hit hard with the thought of something that might have been. I boiled the billy and fried a pound of steak. Been traveling all night, Jack? I asked.
Yes,
said Jack.
I came to Remus yesterday.
He didn't eat. I began to reckon that he was brooding too much for his health. He was much thinner than when I saw him last, and pretty haggard, and he had something of the hopeless haggard look that I'd seen in Tom Hall's eyes after the last big shearing strike, when Tom had worked day and night to hold his mates up all through the hard, bitter struggle, and the battle was lost. Look here, Jack, I said at last. What's up?
Nothing's up, Harry,
said Jack.
What made you think so?
Have you got yourself into any fix? I asked. What's the Hungerford track been doing to you?
No, Harry,
he said.
I'm all right. How are you?
And he pulled some string and papers and a roll of dusty pound notes from his pocket and threw them on the bunk. I was hard up just then, so I took a note and the billy to go to the Royal and get some beer. I thought the beer might loosen his mind a bit.
Better take a couple of quid,
said Jack.
You look as if you want some new shirts and things.
But a pound was enough for me, and I think he had reason to be glad of that later, as it turned out.
Anything new in Burke?
Asked Jack as we drank the beer. No, I said, not a thing, except there's a pretty girl in the Salvation Army.
And it's about time,
growled Jack. Now look here, Jack, I said presently. What's come over you lately at all? I might be able to help you. It's not a bit of use telling me that there's nothing the matter. When a man takes to brooding and traveling alone, it's a bad sign, and it will end in a leaning tree and a bit of clothesline as likely as not. Tell me what the trouble is. Tell us all about it. There's a ghost, isn't there?
Well, I suppose so,
said Jack.
We've all got our ghosts, for that matter. But never you mind, Harry. I'm all right. I don't go interfering with your ghosts, and I don't see what call you've got to come haunting mine. Why, it's as bad as kicking a man's dog.
And he gave the ghost of a grin. Tell me, Jack, I said, is it a woman?
Yes,
said Jack.
It's a woman. Now, are you satisfied?
Is it a girl, I asked?
Yes,
he said. So there was no more to be said. I'd thought it might have been a lot worse than a girl. I thought he might have got married somewhere, sometime, and made a mess of it. We had dinner at Billy Woods's place, and a sensible Christmas dinner it was, everything cold except the vegetables, with the hose going on the veranda in spite of the bylaws, and Billy's wife and her sister, fresh and cool-looking and jolly, instead of being hot and brown and cross like most Australian women who roast themselves over a blazing fire in a hot kitchen on a broiling day, all the morning, to cook scalding plum pudding and red-hot roasts, for no other reason than that their grandmothers used to cook hot Christmas dinners in England. And in the afternoon we went for a row on the river, pulling easily up the Anna Branch and floating down with the stream under the shade of the river timber, instead of going to sleep and waking up helpless and soaked in perspiration, to find the women with headaches, as many do on Christmas Day in Australia. Mrs. Woods tried to draw Jack out, but it was no use, and in the evening he commenced drinking, and that made Billy uneasy.
I'm afraid Jack's on the wrong track,
he said. After tea, most of us collected about Waddy's veranda. Most things that happened in Burke happened at Waddy's pub or near it. If a horse bolted with a buggy or cart, he was generally stopped outside Waddy's, which seemed to suggest, as Mitchell said, that most of the heroes drank at Waddy's, Also, that the pluckiest men were found amongst the hardest drinkers. But sometimes the horse fetched up against Waddy's sign and lamppost, which was a stout one of iron bark, and smashed the trap. Then Waddy's was the Carrier's Arms, a union pub, and Australian teamsters are mostly hard cases. While there was something in Waddy's beer which made men argue fluently, and the best fights came off in his backyard. Waddy's dogs were the most quarrelsome in town, and there was a dog fight there every other evening, followed as often as not by a man fight. If a bushman's horse ran away with him, the chances were that he'd be thrown on to Waddy's veranda, if he wasn't pitched into the bar, and victims of accidents and sick, hard-up shearers were generally carried to Waddy's pub as being the most convenient and comfortable for them. Mitchell denied that it was generosity or good nature on Waddy's part. He said it was all business, advertisement. Waddy knew what he was doing. He was very deep, was Waddy. Mitchell further hinted that if he was sick, he wouldn't be carried to Waddy's, for Waddy knew what a thirsty business a funeral was. Tom Hall reckoned that Waddy bribed the army on the quiet. I was sitting on a stool along the veranda wall with Donald MacDonald, Bob Brothers, the giraffe, and Mitchell, and one or two others, and Jack Moonlight sat on the floor with his back to the wall and his hat well down over his eyes. The army came along at the usual time, but we didn't see the pretty girl at first. She was a bit late. Mitchell said he liked to be at Waddy's when the army prayed, and the pretty girl was there. He had no objection to being prayed for by a girl like that, though he reckoned that nothing short of a real angel could save him now. He said his old grandmother used to pray for him every night of her life and three times on Sunday, with Christmas Day extra when Christmas Day didn't fall on a Sunday. But Mitchell reckoned that the old lady couldn't have had much influence because he became more sinful every year and went deeper in the ways of darkness until finally he embarked on a career of crime. The army prayed, and then a thin, ratty little woman bobbed up in the ring. She'd gone mad on religion as women do on women's rights and hundreds of other things. She was so skinny in the face, her jaws so prominent, and her mouth so wide that when she opened it to speak it was like a ventriloquist's dummy, and you could almost see the cracks open down under her ears.
"They say I'm cracked,"
she screamed in a shrill, cracked voice.
"But I'm not cracked. I'm only cracked on the Lord Jesus Christ. That's all I'm cracked on."
And just then the Amen Man of the army groaner we called him, who was always putting both feet in it, just then he blundered forward, rolled up his eyes, threw his hands up and down as if he were bouncing two balls, and said with deep feeling,
"Thank the Lord she's got a crack in the right place."
Tom Hall doubled up, and most of the other sinners seemed to think there was something very funny about it. And the army, too, seemed struck with an idea that there was something wrong somewhere, for they started a hymn. A big American Negro, who'd been a night watchman in Sydney, stepped into the ring and waved his arms and kept time. And as he got excited, he moved his hands up and down rapidly, as if he was hauling down a rope in a great hurry through a pulley block above, and he kept saying,
"Come down, Lord,"
all through the hymn like a bass accompaniment.
"Come down, Lord, come down, Lord, come down, Lord, come down, Lord."
And the quicker he said it, the faster he hauled. He was as good as a drum. And when the hymn was over, he started to testify.
"My friends,"
he said,
"I was once black as the coals in the mine. I was once black as the ink in the ocean of sin. But now, thank and bless the Lord, I'm whiter than the driven snow."
Tom Hall sat down on the edge of the veranda and leaned his head against a post and cried. He had contributed a bob this evening, and he was getting his money's worth. Then the pretty girl arrived and was pushed forward into the ring. She looked thinner and whiter than I'd ever seen her, and there was a feverish brightness in her eyes that I didn't like.
"Men,"
she said,
"this is Christmas Day."
I didn't hear any more, for at the sound of her voice, Jack Moonlight jumped up as if he'd sat on a baby. He started forward, stared at her for a moment, as if he couldn't believe his eyes, and then said,
"Hannah,"
short and sharp. She started as if she was shot, gave him a wild look, and stumbled forward. The next moment he had her in his arms and was steering for the private parlor. I heard Mrs. Bothways calling for water and smelling salts. She was as fat as Waddy and very much like him in the face, but she was emotional and sympathetic. Then presently I heard, through the open window, the pretty girl say to Jack,
"Oh, Jack, Jack, why did you go away and leave me like that? It was cruel."
"But you told me to go, Hannah,"
said Jack.
That didn't make any difference. Why didn't you write?
She sobbed.
Because you never wrote to me, Hannah,
he said.
That was no excuse,
she said.
It was so cruel of you, Jack.
Mrs. Bothways pulled down the window. A newcomer asked Waddy what the trouble was, and he said that the army girl had only found her chap, her husband, her long-lost brother, or something, but the missus was looking after the business. Then he dozed again. And then we adjourned to the Royal and took the army with us.
That's the way of it,
said Donald MacDonald.
With a woman, it's love or religion. With a man, it's love or the devil.
Or with a man,
said Mitchell presently.
It's love and the devil both sometimes, Donald.
I looked at Mitchell hard, but for all his face expressed, he might only have said,
I think it's gonna rain.
End of That Pretty Girl in the Army by Henry Lawson.
The Hairy Man by Henry Lawson. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Dramatis Personae.
Jack Jones, read by Alan Mapstone.
Andy Page, read by Larry Wilson.
Dave Reagan, read by Lorda.
Jim Bentley, read by Todd.
Mahoney, the Irish Mounted Constable, read by T.J. Burns.
Foley, read by Algie Pug.
And narrated by Son of the Exiles. The Hairy Man. As far back as I can remember, the yarn of the Hairy Man was told in the Blue Mountain district of New South Wales. It scared children coming home by bush tracks from school, and boys out late after lost cows, and even grown bushmen, when going along a lonely track after sunset, would hold their backs hollow and whistle a tune when they suddenly heard a thud, thud of a kangaroo hopping off through the scrub. Other districts also had spooks and bogies, the escaped tiger, the ghost of the convict who'd been done to death and buried in his irons, ghosts of men who had hanged themselves, the ghost of the hawker's wife whose husband had murdered her with a tomahawk in the lonely camp by the track, the ghost of the murdered bushman whose mate quietly stepped behind him as he sat reflecting over a pipe and broken in the back of his head with an axe and afterwards burned the body between two logs. Ghosts of victims whose murders had been avenged, and of undiscovered murders that had been done right enough. All sorts and conditions of ghosts, none of them cheerful, most of them grimly original and characteristic of the weirdly melancholy and aggressively lonely Australian bush. But the Hairy Man was permanent, and his country spread from the eastern slopes of the Great Dividing Range right out to the ends of the Western Spurs. He had been heard of, and seen, and described so often, and by so many reliable liars, that most people agreed that there must be something. The most popular and enduring theory was that he was a gorilla, or an orangutan, which had escaped from a menagerie long ago. He was also said to be a new kind of kangaroo, or the last of a species of Australian mammals which hadn't been discovered yet. Anyway, in some places he was regarded as a danger to children coming home from school, as were wild bullocks, snakes, and an occasional bushman in the DTs. So now and then, when the yarn had a revival, search parties were organised and went out with guns to find the Hairy Man and to settle him and the question one way or the other. But they never found him. Dave Regan, Jim Bentley, and Andy Page, bushmates, had taken a contract to clear and fence the ground for a new cemetery about 3 miles out of the thriving township of Mudgee Budgie. Mudgee Budgie had risen to the dignity of a three-pub town, and people were beginning to die. Up to now, the casual and scarce corpses of Mudgee Budgie, or of Home Rule, a goldfield 6 miles to the west, the bushman who had been thrown from his horse or smashed against a tree while riding recklessly, as bushmen do, or the boozer who had died during a spree in hot weather, had to be taken to the cemetery belonging to the farming town of Buckaroo, about 9 miles east of Mudgee Budgee. This meant a 9 mile, or in the case of home rule, a 15 mile drag, which was a long drawn out agony in blazing hot dusty weather, or even in the rain when the roads were boggy. The Buckaroo undertaker could only be induced to bring his hearse out 2 miles along the road to meet the corpse, which was carried so far in a drag, spring cart, or wagonette. This so detracted from the dignity of Mudgee Budgee and home rule that they agreed to get a cemetery between them, and Dave Regan got the contract to prepare the ground for corpse planting. Dave and his mates camped in an old deserted slab and bark hut, which happened to stand on the ground. It was a lonely place, which stood in a dark stringy bark bush, the nearest house being the hut of a timber getter and his family, about 2 miles along the track on the home rule side. It was the day after anniversary day. Dave and Jim were patriots, and therefore were feeling very repentant and shaky. They had spent the day at the Buckaroo races, half the night in Buckaroo, and the other half in home rule, where the early closing law as regarded public houses was not stringent. They had enjoyed a good time, had bedded and shouted away all their cash, as well as an advance drawn on the contract, had run up scores at all the pubs, and had been in several rows and at least 3 fights. They weren't sure with whom, that was the trouble, but had a drink-lurid recollection of having got off their horses several times on the way home to fight each other. They were too sick to eat or to smoke yet, so they sat outside the hut with their nerves all unstrung and their imaginations therefore particularly active. Under these conditions, they so magnified the awful importance of the unknown and the nightmare portions of the prior night that they felt very dismal and hopeless indeed. Dave had a haunting idea, which grew at last to be a sickening conviction, that he had insulted and had wanted to fight the biggest squatter of the district, from whom he had the promise of a big fencing contract. Jim had a smothering recollection of a row with the leading Mudgee Budgee storekeeper, who gave them credit. And so they swore off drink. They were going to chuck it for good. Each was firmly resolved this time, but they said nothing about it to each other. They had sworn off mutually so often that the thing had become boresome. But the worst of it was they had broken the bottle with the morning reviver, and had nothing to straighten up on, and their nerves were not in a fit state to allow of their going to Mudgee Budgee at the risk of hearing some new and awful truths of last night's doings, and they hadn't the courage to ask Andy to go. They were very contrite and gentle towards him with their "yes, Andy," and "no, Andy," and "no, thank you, Andy," when he fried chops and made coffee for them. The day before they'd both sworn to him, solemnly, affectionately, and at last impatiently and even angrily, that they wouldn't get drunk, that they wouldn't bet, that they wouldn't draw a penny on the contract, that they'd buy a week's provisions first thing, that they'd bring the things home with them on their horses, and that they'd come home early. And now they'd spent his money as well as their own. Andy made no remarks and asked no questions when they woke at midday, and they took his silence in a chastened spirit. Andy Page was a patriot and a democrat too, the most earnest of the three, but he was as obstinately teetotal as he was honest and truthful. Dave was the head of the party, but Andy was the father. Andy had, on several occasions, gone into town with Dave and Jim on pay nights, to look after them, to fight for them if necessary, and to get them home, if possible, when they'd had enough. It was a thankless job, but Andy was loved by his mates, who, nevertheless, when drunk, even wanted to fight him when he stood out against "one more drink for the last." He was as strong physically, as well as morally, as the two put together, and was respected even by the publican, whom he abused for serving his mates when they'd had enough. But the last spree but one had disgusted Andy. He swore he'd never go into town with them again, and like most simple-minded, honest, good-natured fellows whose ideas come slowly, who are slow at arriving at decisions, and whose decisions are nearly invariably right, when he'd once made up his mind, nothing short of a severe shock of earthquake could move him. So he stayed at home on anniversary day and washed and mended his clothes. Dave and Jim were still moping wretchedly about the hut when, towards the middle of the afternoon, an angel came along on horseback. It was Jack Jones from Mudgy Budgy, a drinking mate of theirs, a bush telegraph joker, and the ne'er-do-well of the district. He hung up his shy, spiderly filly under a shed at the back of the hut.
"I thought you chaps would be feeling shaky,"
he said,
"and I've been feeling as lonely and dismal as a bandicoot on a burnt ridge, so I thought I'd come out. I brought a flask of whiskey."
Never were two souls more grateful. Bush mateship is a grand thing, drunk or sober. Andy promptly took charge of the whiskey and proceeded to dole out judicious doses at decent intervals. Jack, who was a sandy-complexioned young fellow with the expression of a born humorist, had some news.
"You know Corny George?"
They had heard of him. He was an old Cornishman who split shingles and palings in the Black Range and lived alone in a hut in a dark gully under the shadow of Dead Man's Gap.
"He went into Buckaroo to the police station yesterday,"
said Jack Jones,
"in a very bad state. He swore he'd seen the hairy man."
"The water?"
"Yes, the hairy man. He swore that the hairy man had come down to his hut the night before last, just after dark, and tried to break in. The hairy man stayed about the hut all night, trying to pull the slabs off the walls and get the bark off the roof, and didn't go away till daylight. Corny says he fired at him two or three times through the cracks with his old shotgun, but the hairy man didn't take any notice. The old chap was pretty shaky on it."
Drink, I suppose,"
grunted Andy contemptuously.
"No, it weren't drink. They reckoned he'd been hatting it too long. They've got him at the police station."
"What did he say the hairy man was like?"
asked Jim Bentley.
"Oh, the usual thing,"
said Jack.
"About as tall as a man and twice as broad. Arms nearly as long as hisself, big wide mouth with grinning teeth, and covered all over with red hair."
"Why, that's just what my uncle said he was like,"
exclaimed Andy Page, suddenly taking great interest in the conversation. He was passing in with some firewood to stick under a pot in which he was boiling a piece of salt beef, but he stood stock still and stared at Jim Bentley with the blank, breathless expression of a man who had just heard astounding news.
"Did your uncle see the hairy man, Andy?"
inquired Dave Regan feebly. He felt too sick to take much interest.
"Yes,"
said Andy, staring at Jack with great earnestness.
"Didn't I tell you? He was driving home up past to Dead Man's Gap, where he lived then. And he seen the hairy man bundling off among the rocks."
Andy paused impressively and stared at Jack.
"And what did your uncle do, Andy?"
asked Jack with a jerky little cough.
"He stood up in the cart and hammered into the horse and galloped it all the way home, full bat up to the door. Then he jumped down, leaving the cart and horse standing there, and went in and lay down on the bed, and wouldn't speak to anybody for 2 hours.
"How long?"
asked Jim, still feebly.
2 hours,
said Andy earnestly, as he went in with the firewood. Jack Jones proposed
a bit of a stroll.
He said it would do them good. He felt an irresistible inclination to giggle and wished to get out of the hearing of Andy, whom he respected. As they slouched along the track, there was an incident which proved the state of their nerves. A big brown snake whipped across the dusty path into a heap of dead boughs. They stared at each other for a full minute. Then Jack summoned courage to ask,
"Did you chaps see that snake?"
"Yes."
"Yes."
And so it was all right. Then they put a match to the boughs and stood round with long sticks till the snake came out. They went back to the hut and managed a cup of coffee. Presently they got on to ghost and hairy man yarns again.
"That was God's truth," said Jack. "That yarn I told you about what happened to me going up Dead Man's Pass, it was just as I told you. I was driving slowly up in that little old spring cart of mine when something, I don't know what it was, made me look behind, and there was a woman walking along behind the cart with her hands on the tailboard. It was just above the spot where the hawker's wife was murdered. She was dressed in black and had black hair, and her face was dead white. At first I thought it was some woman who wanted a lift, or a chap in women's clothes playing the ghost, so I pulled up. And when I looked around again, she was gone. I thought she crouched under the cart, so I whipped up the horse and then looked round again, but there was nothing there. Then I reckon I drove home as fast as Andy's uncle did. You needn't believe me unless you like."
"Thunderstorm coming,"
said Dave, sniffing and looking round the corner to the east.
"I thought this weather would bring something."
"My old,"
said Jim.
"A regular old man storm, too."
The big blue-black bank of storm cloud rose bodily from the east and was right overhead and sweeping down the sunset in a very few minutes. Then the lightning blazed out and swallowed up daylight as well as darkness. But it was not a rainstorm. It was the biggest hailstorm ever experienced in that district. Orchards and vineyards were stripped, and many were ruined. Some said there were stones as big as hen's eggs. Some said the storm lasted over an hour, and some said more, but the time was probably half or three-quarters of an hour. Hail lay feet deep in the old diggers' holes for a fortnight after. The mates half expected the hail to come through the roof of the hut. Just as the storm began to hold up a little, they heard a loud pattering outside and a bang at the door. The door was of hardwood boards with wide cracks. Andy rose to open it, but squinted through a crack first. Then he snatched the big crowbar from the corner, dug the foot of it into the earth floor, and jammed the pointed head under a crosspiece of the door. He did the same with a smaller crowbar and looked wildly round for more material for a barricade.
"What are you doing?"
"Who is it, Andy?"
wildly cried the others.
"It's the hairy man,"
gasped Andy. They quickly got to the door and squinted through the cracks. One squint was sufficient. It was the hairy man right enough. He was about as tall as an ordinary man, but seemed twice as broad across the shoulders. He had long arms and was covered with hair, face and all. He had a big, ugly mouth and wild, bloodshot eyes. So they helped Andy to barricade the door. There was another bang at the door. A cart rattled past, a woman screamed, and the cart went on at an increased pace. There was a shotgun hanging on the wall, loaded. Andy had left it loaded to save ammunition the last time he'd been out kangaroo shooting. Andy, like most slow-thinking men, often did desperate things in a crisis. He snatched down the gun, stepped back a pace or two, aimed at the door low down, and fired. He doesn't know why he aimed low down, except that it
was too much like shooting at a man.
They heard a howl, and the thing, whatever it was, running off. Then they barricaded the door some more ere they scanned the door planking and found that about half the charge had gone through.
"The powder must have got damp,"
said Andy.
"I'll put in a double charge to make sure."
And he reloaded the gun with trembling hands. The other three bumped their heads over the whiskey. They can't say for certain how they got through that night, or what they said or did. The first idea was to get out of there and run to Mudgy Budgy, but they were reluctant to leave their fort. Who'd go out and reconnoitre?
"Besides,"
said Jack Jones,
"we're safer here, and the thing's gone, whatever it was. What would they think of us if we went into town with a yarn about a hairy man?"
He had heard his horse breaking away and didn't care to take the chance of being chased on foot. About an hour later, they heard a horse galloping past and, looking through the cracks, saw a boy riding towards Mudgy Budgy.
"It's young Foley,"
said Jack,
"the son of that old timber getter that's just taken up a selection along the road near Home Rule."
"I wonder what's up,"
said Andy.
"Perhaps the hairy man's been there. We ought to go along and help."
"They can take care of themselves,"
said Jack hurriedly.
"They're close to Home Rule and can get plenty of help. The boy wouldn't ride to Mudgy Budgy if there was anything wrong."
The moon had risen full. Some 2 or 3 hours later, they saw Mahoney, the mounted constable, and the young doctor from Buckaroo ride past towards Home Rule.
"There's something up, right enough,"
said Jim Bentley. Later on, about daybreak, Andy was sitting obstinately on guard, with the gun across his knees and the others dozing on the bunks and waking now and then with jerks, when Constable Mahoney rode up to the door and knocked a business knock that brought them all to their feet. Andy asked him to come in and placed a stool for him, but he didn't see it. He looked round the hut.
"Whose fowl in peace is that?"
he asked.
It's mine,"
said Andy. Mahoney took the gun up and examined it.
"Is this fowl in peace loaded?"
he asked.
"Yes,"
said Andy.
"It is."
"Now listen to me, boys,"
said the constable.
"Was the fowl in peace discharged last night?"
"Yes,"
said Andy.
"It was."
"What's up? What have we done?"
asked Jim Bentley desperately.
"Done?"
shouted Mahoney.
"Done? Why, you filled old Foley's legs with kangaroo shot. That's what you've done. Do you know what that is?"
"No,"
said Jack Jones. He was thinking hard.
"It's manslaughter,"
roared Mahoney.
"That's the meaning of it."
They explained what had happened as far as they were able. Now, Mahoney had a weakness for the boys and a keen sense of humour outside himself.
"Best come along with me,"
he said. Andy had a stiff Sunday sack suit of chocolate colour and a starched white shirt and collar, which he kept in a gin case. He always put them all on when anything happened. On this occasion, he fastened his braces over his waistcoat and didn't notice it until he'd gone some distance along the road. There was great excitement at Foley's shanty, women and children crying and neighbours hanging around. Foley was lying on his face on a stretcher, while the young doctor was taking shot from the hairiest leg that Regan and co. had ever seen on man or beast. The doctor said, afterwards, that some of the shot had only flattened inside the outer skin, and that others had a covering of hair twisted round them. When Foley was turned round to give his dispositions, as Mahoney called them, they saw that he had enough hair on his chest to stuff a set of buggy cushions. He had red whiskers all over his face, rusty red spiky hair all over his head, and a big mouth and bloodshot eyes. He was the hairiest and ugliest man in the district. His language was hardly understandable, partly because of the excitement he was still labouring under, and partly because of his peculiar shade of brogue. Where Mahoney said stone, Foley would say storn, a brogue with a drawl which sounded ridiculous in an angry man. He drawled most over his oaths. It seems that he was splitting fencing timber down
beyond the new cemetery,
when the storm came on. He thought it would be the usual warm thunderstorm, and it was too far to run home. He didn't want to get wet, so he took his clothes off and put them in a hollow log till the storm should be past. Then the lightning played round his tools, the cross-cut saw, axe, wedges, etc., and he had to get away from there. He didn't bargain for
"Them blanky hailstones. It's a wonder I wasn't scalped and drilled full of holes."
He thought of the hut and made for it, but they wouldn't let him in. Then he suddenly saw some women in a tilt cart coming round a bend in the road, and saw no chance of getting out of sight. There was a clearing round the hut, and so he banged at the door again.
"I thought the women would stop."
"Why did you think that?"
asked Mahony.
"What would they stop for?"
"How the hell was I to know? Curiosity, I suppose. They welted into their old house, and as I turned to look after them, the murdering villains inside shot a gun at me. I got back to my clothes and dressed somehow. Someone will have to pay for it. I'll be laid up at me back for 6 weeks."
The young doctor excused himself and went out for a few minutes. Mahony winked at Regan and Party, a wink you could hear, and it comforted them mightily. When they went out, they saw the doctor hanging to a sapling some distance from the hut. He swung with his back to the sapling and slid to the ground, his legs stretched out in front of him. He said he would be all right presently. The thing was fixed up, but the young doctor wanted badly to have the case brought into court. He said it would cheer up the district for years and add 10 years to the life of the oldest inhabitant. End of The Hairy Man by Henry Lawson. Macquarie's Mate by Henry Lawson. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Dramatis Personae.
Awful Example, read by Alan Mapstone.
Box of Tricks, read by Todd.
Baku, read by Algie Pug.
Sally Thompson, read by Michelle Eaton.
Stipner, the Shanty Keeper, read by April 6090.
Macquarie, read by Lorda.
Somebody, read by Andrew Gantz.
And narrated by Son of the Exiles. Macquarie's Mate. The chaps in the bar of Stiffner's Shanty were talking about Macquarie, an absent shearer, who seemed from their conversation to be better known than liked by them.
"I ain't seen Macquarie for ever so long,"
remarked Box of Tricks after a pause.
"Wonder where he could have got to."
"Jail, perhaps. Or hell,"
growled Baku.
"He ain't much loss, any road."
"My oath, you're right, Baku,"
interposed Sally Thompson.
"But now I come to think of it, old Awful Example there was a mate of his one time. Blessed if the old soaker ain't coming to life again."
A shaky, rag and dirt-covered framework of a big man rose uncertainly from a corner of the room, and, staggering forward, brushed the staring thatch back from his forehead with one hand, reached blindly for the edge of the bar with the other, and drooped heavily.
"Well, Awful Example,"
demanded the shanty keeper,
"what's up with you now?"
The drunkard lifted his head and glared wildly round with bloodshot eyes.
Don't you talk about him. Drop it, I say. Drop it."
"What the devil's the matter with you now, anyway?"
growled the barman.
"Got him again? Hey!"
Don't you talk about Macquarie. He's a mate of mine. Here, give me a drink."
Well, what if he is a mate of yours?
Sneered Baku.
It don't reflect much credit on you. Nor him, neither.
The logic contained in the last three words was unanswerable. An awful example was still fairly reasonable, even when rum oozed out of him at every pore. He gripped the edge of the bar with both hands, let his ruined head fall forward until it was on a level with his temporarily rigid arms, and stared blindly at the dirty floor. Then he straightened himself up, still keeping his hold on the bar.
"Some of you chaps,"
he said huskily.
"One of you chaps in this bar today called Macquarie a scoundrel, and a loafer, and a blackguard, and a sneak, and a liar."
"Well, what if we did?"
said Baku defiantly.
"He's all that, and a cheat into the bargain. And now, what are you going to do about it?"
The old man swung sideways to the bar, rested his elbow on it, and his head on his hand.
"Macquarie wasn't a sneak, and he wasn't a liar,"
he said in a quiet, tired tone.
"And Macquarie weren't a cheat."
"Well, old man, you needn't get your rag out about it,"
said Sally Thompson soothingly.
"Perhaps we was a bit too hard on him, and it isn't altogether right, chaps, considering he's not here. But then, you know, awful, he might have acted straight to you that was his mate. The meanest blank, if he is a man at all, will do that."
"Ah, to blazes with the old sot,"
shouted Baku.
"I gave my opinion about Macquarie, and what's more, I'll stand to it."
I've got a point for the defence,"
the old man went on, without heeding the interruptions.
"I've got a point or two for the defence."
"Well, let's have at it,"
said Stiffner.
"In the first place, Macquarie never talked about no man behind his back."
There was an uneasy movement and a painful silence. Baku reached for his drink and drank slowly. He needed time to think. Box of Tricks studied his boots. Sally Thompson looked out at the weather. The shanty keeper wiped the top of the bar very hard. And the rest shifted round and supposed they'd try a game of cards. Baku set his glass down very softly, pocketed his hands deeply and defiantly, and said,
"Well, what of that? Macquarie was as strong as a bull, and the greatest bully on the river into the bargain. He could call a man a liar to his face, and smash his face afterwards. And he did it often, too, and with smaller men than himself."
There was a breath of relief in the bar.
"Do you want to make out that I'm talking about a man behind his back?"
continued Baku, threateningly, to Awful Example.
"You'd best take care, old man."
"Macquarie wasn't a coward,"
remonstrated the drunkard softly, but in an injured tone.
"What's up with you anyway?"
yelled the publican.
"What you're growling at? Do you want a row? Get out of it if you can't be agreeable."
The boozer swung his back to the bar, hooked himself on by his elbows, and looked vacantly out of the door.
"I've got another point for the defence,"
he muttered.
"It's always best to keep the last point to the last."
"Oh, Lord, well, out with it. Out with it."
"Macquarie's dead. That's what it is."
Everyone moved uneasily. Sally Thompson turned the other side to the bar, crossed one leg behind the other, and looked down over his hip at the sole and heel of his elastic side. The barman rinsed the glasses vigorously. Long Bones shuffled and dealt on the top of a cask, and some of the others gathered round him and got interested. Baku thought he heard his horse breaking away and went out to see to it, followed by Boxer Tricks and a couple more who thought that it might be one of their horses. Someone, a tall, gaunt, determined-looking bushman with square features and haggard grey eyes, had ridden in unnoticed through the scrub to the back of the shanty and dismounted by the window. When Baku and the others re-entered the bar, it soon became evident that Sally Thompson had been thinking, for presently he came to the general rescue as follows.
There's a blessed lot of tommy rot about dead people in this world. A lot of damned old woman nonsense. There's more sympathy wasted over dead and rotten skunks than there is justice done to straight, honest living chaps. I don't believe in this gory sentiment about the dead at the expense of the living. I believe in justice for the living, and the dead too for that matter, but justice for the living. Macquarie was a bad egg, and it don't alter the case if he was dead 1,000 times.
There was another breath of relief in the bar, and presently somebody said,
"You're right, Sally."
"Good for you, Sally, old man,"
cried Boxer Tricks, taking it up.
"And besides, I don't believe Macquarie is dead at all. He's always dying, or being reported dead, and then turning up again. Where did you hear about it, Awful?"
The example ruefully rubbed a corner of his roof with the palm of his hand.
There's a lot in what you say, Sally Thompson,"
he admitted slowly, totally ignoring Box of Tricks.
But...
"Oh, we've had enough of the old fool,"
yelled Baku.
"Macquarie was a spieler, and any man that'd be his mate ain't much better."
"Here, take a drink and dry up, your old hoss,"
said the man behind the bar, pushing a bottle and glass towards the drunkard.
"Do you want a row?"
The old man took the bottle and glass in his shaking hands and painfully poured out a drink.
"There's a lot in what Sally Thompson says,"
he went on obstinately.
But...
he added in a strained tone.
"There's another point that I near forgot, and none of you seem to think of it. Not even Sally Thompson nor Boxer Tricks there."
Stiffner turned his back and Baku spat viciously and impatiently.
"Yes,"
drivelled the drunkard.
"I've got another point for the defence of my mate Macquarie."
"Oh, out with it. Spit it out for God's sake, or you'll bust,"
roared Stiffner.
"What the blazes is it?"
"His mate's alive,"
yelled the old man.
"Macquarie's mate's alive, that's what it is."
He reeled back from the bar, dashed his glass and hat to the boards, gave his pants a hitch by the waistband that almost lifted him off his feet, and tore at his shirt sleeves.
"Make a ring, boys,"
he shouted.
"His mate's alive. Put up your hands, Baku. By God, his mate's alive."
Someone had turned his horse loose at the rear and had been standing by the back door for the last 5 minutes. Now he slipped quietly in.
"Keep the old fool off, or he'll get hurt,"
snarled Baku. Stiffner jumped the counter. There were loud, hurried words of remonstrance, then some stump-splitting oaths and a scuffle, consequent upon an attempt to chuck the old man out. Then a crash. Stiffner and Box of Tricks were down. Two others were holding Baku back, and someone had pinned Awful Example by the shoulders from behind.
"Let me go,"
he yelled, too blind with passion to notice the movements of surprise among the men before him.
"Let me go. I'll smash any man that says a word against a mate of mine behind his back. Baku, I'll have your blood." Let me go. I'll. Who's holding me? You.
It's Macquarie, old mate,
said a quiet voice. Baku thought he heard his horse again and went out in a hurry. Perhaps he thought that the horse would get impatient and break loose if he left it any longer, for he jumped into the saddle and rode off. End of Macquarie's Mate by Henry Lawson.
His Country, After All by Henry Lawson. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Dramatis Personae.
Australian-born American, read by Wayne Cook.
New Zealand Bagman, read by Jim Locke.
Coach Driver, read by Todd.
Posh-sounding British voice, read by Alan Mapstone.
Australian Rabbit Trapper, read by L.G. Pug.
Narrator, read by Kristen Hand. The Blenheim coach was descending into the valley of the Avetary River from the saddle of Taylor's Pass. Across the river to the right, the gray slopes and flats stretched away to the distant sea from a range of tussock hills. There was no native bush there, but there were several groves of imported timber standing wide apart, sentinel-like, seeming lonely and striking in their isolation.
Grand country, New Zealand, eh?
Said a stout man with a brown face, gray beard, and gray eyes, who sat between the driver and another passenger on the box.
You don't call this grand country,
exclaimed the other passenger, who claimed to be, and looked like, a commercial traveler, and might have been a professional spieler, quite possibly both.
Why, it's about the poorest country in New Zealand. You ought to see some of the country in the North Island, Wairarapa and Napier districts, round about Pahiatua. I call this damn poor country.
Well, I reckon you wouldn't if you'd ever been in Australia, back in New South Wales. The people here don't seem to know what a grand country they've got. You say this is the worst, eh? Well, this would make an Australian cockatoo's mouth water. The worst of New Zealand would.
I always thought Australia was all good country,
mused the driver, a flax stick.
I always thought...
Good country,
exclaimed the man with the gray beard in a tone of disgust.
Why, it's only a mongrel desert, except some bits round the coast. The worst dried-up and God-forsaken country I was ever in.
There was a silence, thoughtful on the driver's part and aggressive on that of the stranger.
I always thought,
said the driver reflectively after the pause,
I always thought Australia was a good country.
And he placed his foot on the brake. They let him think. The coach descended the natural terraces above the river bank and pulled up at the pub.
So you're a native of Australia?
Said the bagman to the greybeard as the coach went on again.
Well, I suppose I am. Anyway, I was born there. It's the main thing I've got against the darned country.
How long did you stay there?
Till I got away,
said the stranger. Then, after a think, he added,
I went first when I was 35, went to the islands. Swore I'd never go back to Australia again. But I did. I thought I had a kind of affection for old Sydney. I knocked about the blasted country for 5 or 6 years, then cleared out to Frisco. So I'd never go back again, and I never will.
But surely you'll take a run over and have a look at old Sydney and those places before you go back to America after getting so near.
What the blazes do I want to have a look at the blamed country for?
Snapped the stranger, who had refreshed considerably.
I've got nothing to thank Australia for, except getting out of it. It's the best country to get out of that I was ever in.
Oh, well, I only thought you might have had some friends over there.
Interposed the traveler in an injured tone.
Friends? That's another reason. I wouldn't go back there for all the friends and relations since Adam. I had more than quite enough of it while I was there. The worst and hardest years of my life were spent in Australia. I might have starved there, and did do it half my time. I worked harder and got less in my own country in 5 years than I ever did in any other in 15.
He was getting mixed.
And I've been in a few since then. No, Australia's the worst country that ever the Lord had the sense to forget. I mean to stick to the country that stuck to me when I was starved out of my dear old native land. And that country is the United States of America. What's Australia? A big, thirsty, hungry wilderness with one or two cities for the convenience of foreign speculators and a few collection of humpies called towns, also for the convenience of foreign speculators, and populated mostly by mongrel sheep and partly by fools who live like European slaves in the towns and like dingoes in the bush, who drivel about democracy and yet haven't any more spunk than to graft for a few Cockney dudes that razzle-dazzle most of the time in Paris. Why, the Australians haven't even got the grit to claim enough of their own money to throw a few dams across their watercourses and so make some of the interior fit to live in. America's bad enough, but was never so small as that. Bah! The curse of Australia is sheep. And the Australian war cry is, bah-ha-ha-ha-ha.
Well, you're the first man I ever heard talk as you've been doing about his own country,
said the bagman, getting tired and impatient of being sat on all the time.
Lives there a man with a soul so dead who never said to himself, I forget the darn thing?
He tried to remember it. The man whose soul was dead cleared his throat for action, and the driver, for whom the bagman had shouted twice as against the strangers once, took the opportunity to observe that he always thought a man ought to stick up for his own country. The stranger ignored him and opened fire on the bagman. He proceeded to prove that that was all rot, that patriotism was the greatest curse on earth, that it had been the cause of all war, that it was the false, ignorant sentiment which moved men to slave, starve, and fight for the comfort of their sluggish masters, that it was the enemy of universal brotherhood, the mother of hatred, murder, and slavery, and that the world would never be any better until the deadly poison, called the sentiment of patriotism, had been educated out of the stomachs of the people.
Patriotism,
he exclaimed scornfully.
My country. The darn fools. The country never belonged to them but to the speculators, absentees, land boomers, swindlers, and gangs of thieves. The men the patriotic fools starve and fight for. Their masters. Bah-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha.
The opposition collapsed. The coach had climbed the terraces on the south side of the river and was bowling along on a level stretch of road across the elevated flat.
What trees are those?
Asked the stranger, breaking the aggressive silence which followed his unpatriotic argument, and pointing to a grove ahead by the roadside.
They look like if they've been planted there. There ain't been a forest here, surely.
Oh, there are some trees the government imported,
said the traveler, whose knowledge on the subject was limited.
Our own bush won't grow in this soil.
But it looks as if anything else would.
Here the stranger sniffed once by accident, and then several times with interest. It was a warm morning after rain. He fixed his eyes on those trees. They didn't look like Australian gums. They tapered to the tops, the branches were pretty regular, and the boughs hung in ship-shape fashion. There was not the Australian heat to twist the branches and turn the leaves.
Why,
exclaimed the stranger, still staring and sniffing hard.
Why, dang me if they ain't Australian gums.
Yes,
said the driver, flicking his horses.
They are.
Blanky, Blanky old Australian gums!
Exclaimed the ex-Australian with strange enthusiasm.
They are not old,
said the driver.
They are only young trees. But they say they don't grow like that in Australia. Count of the difference in the climate. I always thought...
But the other did not appear to hear him. He kept staring hard at the trees they were passing. They had been planted in rows and cross rows and were coming on grandly. There was a rabbit trapper's camp amongst those trees. He had made a fire to boil his billy with gum leaves and twigs, and it was the scent of that fire which interested the exile's nose and brought a wave of memories with it.
Good day, mate,
he shouted suddenly to the rabbit trapper, and to the astonishment of his fellow passengers.
Good day, mate.
The answer came back like an echo, it seemed to him, from the past. Presently he caught sight of a few trees which had evidently been planted before the others, as an experiment, perhaps, and somehow one of them had grown after its own erratic native fashion, gnarled and twisted and ragged, and could not be mistaken for anything else but an Australian gum.
It's under an old blue gum,
ejaculated the traveller, regarding the tree with great interest. He screwed his neck to get a last glimpse, and then sat silently smoking and gazing straight ahead, as if the past lay before him, and it was before him.
Ah, well,
he said, in explanation of a long meditative silence on his part.
Ah, well, them saplings. The smell of them gum leaves set me thinking.
And he thought some more.
Well, for my part,
said a tourist in the coach presently, in a condescending tone,
I can't see much in this Australia. The bally colonies are...
Oh, that be damned,
snarled the Australian-born. They had finished the second flask of whiskey.
What you bastards know about Australia? She's as good as England anyway.
Well, I suppose you'll go straight back to the States as soon as you've done your business in Christchurch,
said the bagman. When near their journey's end, they had become confidential.
Well, I don't know. I reckon I'll just take a run over to Australia first. There's no mate of mine in business in Sydney, and I'd like to have a yarn with him.
End of His Country After All by Henry Lawson.